You're listening to Space Rants, the best podcast in a 10 light year radius. I'm Seth. Welcome to the show. This is episode 2, and we're going to immediately get into the meat and potatoes, talking about alien life. A lot of people have suggested longer episodes, so we're going to try it out this time. Let me know what you think. Now, I don't really like doing this, but let me start here by declaring a couple of stances that I have based on assumptions. Does life exist elsewhere in the universe? Absolutely yes, and not just because we've sent microbial hitchhikers to the moon, Mars, and beyond. The universe is vast and ancient. Pick a direction, head that way, and eventually you will probably find biological activity. Does complex life exist elsewhere in the universe? Almost certainly. Now, there's a lot to it, including how you define complexity, but I'd bet $20 that we're not the only ones to have built a few particle colliders in our time. Basically, it's the same argument as before. The universe is vast and ancient. Now, has complex life visited Earth recently? Maybe abducted a few cattle and drew some naughty shapes in a cornfield before crashing in Roswell? No, I will save that rant for another episode in full. But the short version is no. I mention all of this because I want to start by making it clear that while I might not believe in a particular report of an alien technosignature detection or any non-peer-reviewed report of alien interaction, I am 99% convinced that they are out there, probably very far away, and probably they have no idea that we exist. But advanced alien life is definitely out there. As we prepare for today's rant, I want to make sure we all have a couple of tools in the tool belt. So, first of all, SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This can be both a general term and also a reference to the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. We're also going to talk about Dyson structures, so popularized by the British-born American physicist Freeman Dyson in a 1960 paper. The eponymous Dyson sphere is a habitat built in a spherical shape around a star for the purposes of collecting all of that star's energy and also providing an incomprehensibly tremendous surface area on which a civilization may live. Now, I can't find the full version of his original paper online, so I don't know how developed the concept of the structure was in that paper, but I do think that Dyson's intent was really to predict the type of heat signatures that such a structure would generate, and not really to assess its mechanical advantages and disadvantages. I think it was really more of a thought experiment to him, this sphere. But just thinking about it, you can figure out pretty quick that any sort of literal sphere or a ring world would need to maintain this absurdly precise balancing act, and even the slightest mass imbalance would compound as gravity would attract the parent star and the closest or densest part of that structure, and this would make building the thing in the first place a total nightmare, let alone, you know, maintaining that delicate balance for eons, right? Far more doable is a swarm of solar collectors and habitats, each sized to their own purpose and need, and all, you know, orbiting the parent star together. So in homage to Freeman Dyson, we would call that a Dyson swarm. And there are many different, you know, versions of this idea of mega structures harnessing the power of a star directly, and so they're usually called a Dyson what have you. Next up, proposed by Soviet astronomer Nikolai Kardashev in 1964, the eponymous Kardashev scale loosely and theoretically classifies advanced alien civilizations, or perhaps our own one day, by the magnitude of their power consumption. So basically, a type 1 civilization can capture all of the energy from their parent star, which strikes their home planet. In theory, we, humanity, could be a type 1 civilization, but in practice, we are not. Now, a type 2 civilization can harness all of the energy from their parent star, period. This is usually accomplished, at least we imagine, by use of a Dyson structure of some sort. So you're going right to the primary source and using that raw, unfiltered solar power for your K2 civilization. A type 3 civilization can harness power on the scale of a galaxy. I'll go out on a limb here and guess that such a civilization probably does not exist, at least not in our supercluster, because we probably would have noticed it by now. Just an entire galaxy, you know, dimmer than it should be, and then like putting out some weird extra infrared as heat, you know. There's no type threes, at least not nearby. But basically, those three types of civilizations, that's Kardashev for you, or his scale. Now, the scale has changed a lot over time. It's got many iterations at this point. And I don't think it was ever really meant to be taken quite so literally. We struggle to develop robust systems of classification for things that we know exist. Many of us remember when our system for defining planets changed pretty radically in 2006. To an extent, biology continues to be hampered by the Linnaean system of classification, which was excellent for its time, and now is just kind of sticking around. So, to use the Kardashev scale moving forward, as we, you know, eventually, inevitably do find advanced alien life somewhere, we're probably going to have to get rid of it or update it to the point where it's unrecognizable. But that certainly is not to diminish the utility of this scale as a convenient shorthand. Just a couple more things here. Let's talk about the transit method. So let's say there's an alien civilization out there, right? And they happen to orbit a parent star that's almost perfectly edge-on with our solar system, right? So if you draw an imaginary plane out from the equator of our star and then kind of zoom out, you can visualize all of the planets orbiting pretty close to that plane, right? They might go a little above, a little below, but they're basically on that plane. That's the solar ecliptic. So you keep zooming out light years and light years and light years, and eventually you get to this other star, right? And they've got a telescope pointed at our sun. And what they notice is that that sun, which to them, maybe they can't image the solar disk, so functionally to them, it's just a point source of light. And that point source dims by about 1% every 11.9 years. So they would only need to observe that once to guess that there's a planet there, and they would basically have discovered Jupiter in that way, right? And then maybe they would want to keep observing, and then almost 12 years later, they would see that same dip again, and they would say, aha, we have confirmed that exoplanet candidate. They've got a gas giant, you know, so far out from the sun. There's a planet there, right? And Saturn would exact a similar toll on the sun, except that would be roughly every 29 and a half years, and maybe its rings would throw them for a bit of a loop at first, but I'm sure they'd figure it out. Now, of course, these aliens would not be measuring these time periods in Earth years, but the point is that those intervals would remain constant, right? So looking for those types of dips in stellar brightness is the basis of the transit method, and we already have several programs and missions using it to try and find planets orbiting other stars. Case in point, the Kepler mission. So Kepler is an optical telescope. It mostly measures visible light, the kind that you and I can see, plus a little on either side. It's observed over 500,000 stars in the single field, basically in the constellation of Cygnus, the Swan. It made over 6,000 exoplanet candidate detections. And the list of confirmed exoplanets has now ballooned to over 2800. For perspective, before the Kepler mission, according to NASA's exoplanet catalog, there were only about 400 confirmed exoplanets. And remember, one of the limitations to Kepler's detection method here is that it has to be seeing these alien stars like perfectly edge on to catch these planets. So for this mission to return these kinds of results, it basically surprised everybody. And we now know that planets are a pretty ubiquitous thing. Basically, every star has at least one of them. One of the other problems with Kepler is that it was in operation between 2009 and 2018. So that's 9 years in total, 4 years basically for the primary mission. And you may be thinking, well, Seth, you said that Jupiter orbits our sun once every 12 years, so assuming they detected a Jupiter-like planet, Kepler is no longer in operation to detect it again, right? It couldn't make that confirmation, and that's one of the reasons why Kepler makes exoplanet candidate detections and does not necessarily confirm those exoplanets. Kepler's detections in most cases are followed up by, you know, other telescopes or ground-based observations. Another thing to note is that Kepler cannot image stellar or planetary disks. We can know that a star is dimming using Kepler data based on a dip in what they call the light curve, right? We know what the star's normal energy output is. We can see that little dip as the planet blocks it out, and then we can see it return to normal as the planet finishes transiting the star. But we can't really see a clean black circle blocking out part of a larger yellow circle or something like that. And lastly, let's talk about KIC 846-2852. No, that's not my phone number. It's a star. First cataloged by humans in the 1800s. It's about 1,400 light years away in the constellation of Cygnus, right where Kepler was pointing at during its survey. It's a main sequence F-type star, so yellow-white. It's about 1.4 solar masses, so about 40% more massive than our sun. It's about 1.5 solar radii, or about 50% greater in radius than our own star. The age of the star is not precisely known, but we do know that the average lifespan of an F-type star is about 5 billion years, and its main sequence, so let's peg it at about half that, right? So it's about 2.5 billion years old, probably. There's no wobble detected in this star. It appears to have a stable axis. It's not alone. Boyajian et al. In 2016 revealed a companion red dwarf star about 880 astronomical units away. One astronomical unit is the distance between our sun and the Earth. So 880 times that distance from this star, there is a little red dwarf, which they immediately and appropriately, I think, named KIC 846-2852b. And follow-up studies do show that this red dwarf is gravitationally bound. It's a binary pair. Now you may be screaming at me, Seth, Boyajian et al. Is Professor Tabitha Boyajian, aka Tabby, a professional astronomer who is now a pop science icon? Let's talk about that. Well, you just beat me to the punch. Here we go. But first, let's have a word from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Occam's Razors. Occam's makes the highest quality grooming products for critical thinkers. But don't take my word for it. Gather data to verify precision and validity. Have your friends try Occam's to verify reproducibility. Yes, for the parsimonious shaving experience, try Occam's Razor. And remember, folks, don't knock 'em till you tried 'em. And had your friends try 'em. Several times. And we're back. as you've probably guessed, we're not talking about KIC 8462852, because nothing happened there. Let's discuss the anomaly. So Kepler was up there gathering data, right? Primary mission was from 2009 to 2013. So pretty soon after that, scientists start combing that initial influx of data, right? And not just scientists. Citizen scientists were helping just comb through this mission data for exoplanet transit signatures through a number of efforts. But in this case, we're namely Yale's Planet Hunters Project. So what these volunteers discovered were two small dips around day 140 and day 260 in the Kepler data for this star. What was odd about these dips, though, is that, like, take the one at day 140, right? The D140 dip. This was in May 2009 when the data was collected, being analyzed in 2014-2015. They find a week-long dip in the light output of this star. They thought, that's weird. A transit usually takes, you know, a couple of hours. It was a week long? And the dip was asymmetric. So you would expect to see there's a small amount of time over which, you know, the star goes from its baseline brightness to down significantly less, you know, 1%. Not a lot, but a significant, you know, statistically significant amount. And then you would expect, as the planet finishes that transit, that the star returns to its baseline brightness at almost exactly the same rate, right? That did not happen. It went down very differently than it went up. And it wasn't this almost immediate step. It was this long, gradual, curving thing. It was weird. It was really weird, because we call it a light curve, but it's not normally a curve. And it was pretty massive. It looked big, like we're going to need a bigger boat, big. So there were those two dips, and, you know, I thought, well, that's odd. Okay. So then, moving on to day 800 of the data, right? This would be March of 2011. There's a 15% dip. Now remember, Jupiter would produce like a 1% dip in the brightness of our star, right? 15% dip. Now we definitely need a bigger boat. This is another week-long event. Again, asymmetric dimming versus brightening at the start and end of the transit. And also, this time is like almost perfectly smooth, the curves on either side, which is just very odd. Very little noise, especially on the dimming side. And then around day 1500, so February up through May of 2013, the end of the Kepler mission, right? That's when, as Heywood Floyd said in 2010, the year we make contact, everything went wacko. Series of irregular dips. There was a mix of smooth and sharp dims. There was tons of sub-events varying from, you know, these day-long things to week-long. And at one point, the star dropped in brightness by up to like 22%. Again, Jupiter is 1%. We're seeing 22%. The story goes that the citizen scientists brought this stuff to the professional scientists, and the professional scientists, of course, immediately said, experimental error. Let's just check on that real quick. They worked with NASA technicians, ruled out data-gathering errors with the Kepler telescope. So now they're just left with a mess, right? What are we going to do? And so Professor Boyajian and her whole team collaborated on kind of the paper on the subject, right? Published in September of 2015. Where's the flux? You can tell what it stands for. Just work backwards. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence is to SETI, as where's the flux is to... Okay. Well, things weren't just going wacko in the data. In October of 2015, Ross Anderson published The Most Mysterious Star in Our Galaxy. And in this article, he announced that Professor Jason Wright, an astronomer from Penn State University and a colleague of Tabitha Boyajian, was about to publish a paper demonstrating that this was an alien megastructure. Now, Wright et al. Did publish that paper in October of 2015, and in that paper, he recommended the star system as a SETI target, which to me seems an appropriately measured response. And in a later blog post, Wright said he felt, quote, a bit embarrassed, end quote, about how reporters overstated evidence, especially with tabloids picking up the story. Now, there was some kind of pop science urging temperance and caution. Edward Schmidt, an astrophysicist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, published a list of 21 stars exhibiting similar behavior. And like all good scientists, Schmidt called for more research into the phenomena. His and others' efforts to contextualize the KIC 846-2852 findings seem to be kind of largely ineffective, and people largely just kind of pretended that Tabby Star was the only star to have ever shown something this weird. At least that's my impression, having lived through it. So let's take a moment, step back, and just think, okay, what could the possibilities have been, right? Maybe a planet with insanely huge rings. We've actually found some planets with ring systems that are just beyond. But 22%, probably not. Let's keep looking. Maybe a coronal mass ejection, right? This was before we'd seen Betelgeuse dim by 40%, just because it cut the cosmic cheese, basically. It was just a giant gas cloud erupting in our direction, which then obscured the light of the star. So maybe something like that. Well, that doesn't explain all the micro dips and the dips within the dips. Well, let's keep looking. Maybe variability in the star's brightness. Wikipedia has a page on stars that dim oddly, so, you know, that is a thing. And eruptive variable stars are a known thing. So could be that, but it's not quite, you know, meeting any of those profiles. Maybe a debris cloud of some sort. So a protoplanetary disk, we've seen tons of those. They're fairly uniform, and they also have a distinct infrared signature, which was not being observed in this case. Remnant material from a coronal mass ejection or a mega flare, maybe, but again, we generally know what that looks like, and that's not really what we were seeing in this case. The curves didn't really match it. Maybe the debris cloud was from planets crashing into each other, kind of like the impact that created the moon. And section 4.4.3 of What's the Flux deals with this directly by predicting a debris field about 1.6 astronomical units from the star, and predicted future dimming events basically every 750 days. And so then it predicted two more in April of 2015 and May of 2017. However, this prediction was like immediately challenged in the following paragraph. And to my knowledge, these predictions were not verified by further observation. Maybe it wasn't generated by an impact, but you could have a bunch of comets or asteroids gravitationally displaced by a passing star, like the red dwarf that they discovered in 2016. And even before discovering the red dwarf that would turn this star system into a binary pair, this was widely regarded as the kind of least bad explanation in terms of fitting all of the data in the story so far. And of course, everybody's favorite explanation, aliens! Oh my god, you guys, it's aliens! But like, not on a planet, it's aliens! Yay! Now, this is the scenario that Jason Wright was entertaining around Tabby Star in that 2015 paper where he suggested follow-up on, you know, with this star as a SETI target. And he was specifically talking about a Dyson swarm. So we're talking about a type 2 civilization on the Kardashev scale, right? Now, one other possibility, maybe it's not a mega structure, maybe it's like mega destruction. You know, maybe the Death Star just blew up Alderaan around Tabby Star, right? And so that's what we're seeing. It could be. This whole thing is so disorganized, the data is so all over the place, that it seems to me, at least, pretty likely that we're watching something dynamic, that we're watching something happen, right? We don't think about this, but on a scale of deep time, on astronomical time, we're watching something really magical happen around Saturn. Those rings are not permanent. Saturn ripped apart a moon. It was like face off. And, well, okay, it wasn't actually like that. But a moon got too close to Saturn, and the gravitational, the tidal differential between the far side of the moon and the near side of the moon overcame the binding energy of what the moon was made of, and so it split. And then that happened a couple more times. Possibly an awful lot of times. And the end result is a debris field in this nice, beautiful, clean ring around Saturn. And it's continuing to spiral in towards the planet. And in a couple hundred million years, we won't have it anymore. So this is an incredibly dynamic event that we're getting to live through. And we're lucky, you know, assuming that humanity survives that long, our progeny will not see Saturn's rings. So maybe there's something like that similar going on here, some cosmically destructive event, maybe even a little bit more dynamic than Saturn's rings, right? That's happening. And we're seeing the collision and the ejecta and all the clouds of debris and all that kind of stuff. Ultimately, it's just a matter of time and observing the star continuously to establish the periodicity of any of these dips. Now, something that I've really not seen get much lip service is that transits do not necessarily mean orbits. So at this point, right, we know that a point source of light is dimming. Now, that's likely because something is blocking it, meaning that some object is probably intersecting this imaginary straight line that you could draw between the Kepler telescope and this star. Now, this in and of itself does not mean that the object is orbiting the star, right? All it means is that something's kind of coming in between. None of these dips have been shown to be periodic yet. So a rogue cloud of interstellar comets or something like that, you know, that's a pretty far out concept. But is it really equally as far out as aliens, which is seriously being considered here? I don't think so. I would like to see, maybe a little bit more consideration for this theory. Or at least a robust explanation of why it's not a good one. So I've hinted at the importance of following up, right? We just need to keep observing this star, And ideally from multiple sources. So in October 2015, the American Association of Variable Star Observers published an alert notice requesting amateur and professional astronomers from around the world observe this star. The campaign is currently ongoing until further notice. It's not too late. You could join in. In October 2015, SETI, the real SETI, brought the Allen Telescope Array to bear. And in November 2015, they announced no extraterrestrial technosignatures detected. An optical study in 2016 yielded similar results. In 2016, Boyajian et al. Teamed up with the Breakthrough Listen project out of UC Berkeley, and they used the Green Bank Observatory, the world's largest single radio telescope, to follow up on the Kepler detection. And when this leaked to the press, they all went nuts again, but they didn't go nuts over the results. In fact, I couldn't even find a paper on their findings from this time. But there is a plethora, just a cornucopia, of other relevant studies, and you can just start by going to Professor Boyajian's website, www.wheresTheFlux.com. Not a paid promotion. I'm just saying you can start your quest for knowledge there. Now, Green Bank may have proven a little inconclusive there, but nobody was giving up. So in 2016, Tabitha Boyajian and Jason Wright, you remember him, said it's a good SETI target, right? So they set up a Kickstarter to buy a year's worth of time at the Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope Network, or LCOGT, to continue observing this star. For a while it was called Tabby's star, now we're calling it Boyajian's star. The campaign exceeded its $100,000 goal, and they began observing. January 2018 saw two very sad papers published. Basically, if an object is opaque, then by definition it blocks out all of the light being measured, right? We're going to go on a little bit of an aside here. So basically, If an object is opaque, then by definition it blocks out all the light being measured. So, if you were using a red, green, and blue light sensor, each of them, right, to measure the intensity of a white light, they probably all show equal levels of detection. Then you block out that light with an opaque object, and you'd expect all of those detectors to show an equal drop in the amount of light that they were collecting, right? But take that same setup and now hold your hand in front of that light source, and the red sensor will not show as much of a drop as the other two. Red light will be allowed to pass through your hand at a greater rate than the blue or the green because of your blood vessels. I don't know if you've ever held up your hand to a really high-powered white light, but it's super nifty. Anyway, this concept is the basis of multi-band photometry, which is basically making an observation at a variety of wavelengths. Now, planets are known for their opacity. They block out light, right? This is how night literally works. So, Boyajian et al. Reasoned that if KIC 846-2852 were being transited by planets, some good old multi-band photometry would show a drop in every wavelength of light for each transit. Now, the team detected and named four dimming episodes between March 2016 and December 2017, and each time they found that the star got significantly dimmer at some wavelengths than others. In fact, it was a dimming profile we've seen plenty of times before. These four detections were almost certainly dust. All of them. Definitely not opaque, and therefore not planets, not Dyson-type alien megastructures. Okay, so if you were rooting for the aliens, this is a bit of a setback. Is it really the last nail in the coffin, though? I mean, to be clear, the LCOGT observations do not totally rule out planets or megastructures around Boyajian's star. We're talking about less than one Martian year of data. So, especially for an F-type star, this survey could have easily missed something orbiting in the life zone. So, based on one sequence of dips, Ballesteros et al. Predicted a transit of an asteroid and comet field in early 2021 and a transit of the main object in the first half of 2023. So they modeled this main object as a ringed gas giant with the asteroid field similar to the Trojan fields that you'll tend to find at the fifth Lagrange points of planets here in our solar system. And it's at this time that I am just thrilled to announce that Professor Boyajian herself has agreed to come on the show in a few months after she's had a chance to observe, and therefore test, the periodicity of some of these dips that have been observed in the past. So thank you in advance, Professor. This means the world to me, and we can decide which world it means to me when we have our little chat. But I am just... Is over the moon a pun in this instance? I don't know. But I can't wait. Now, no matter what's going on around Boyajian's star, more study is warranted. While it's really probably almost certainly not aliens at this point, whatever we do learn could tell us a lot about stellar life cycles or what happens when planets collide or who knows what about whatever's going on over there. Personally, the fact that it's almost certainly not aliens neither surprises nor disappoints me, and I'm still very excited about what we will be learning almost certainly within the next couple of months, but so long as telescopes remain trained on this star, there's going to be the opportunity to gather more data, and who knows what we'll learn. Who knows what assumptions are going to be challenged based on what we find. I think it's terrific. I'm looking forward to continuing to follow the study on this star, even after the hubbub has died down, right? I'm definitely not surfing the wave by talking about this star now, but the story is far from over. So, as I brushed up on this topic and really went in depth in a couple of places to kind of strengthen what I knew to prepare for this episode. There was this silence that I noticed on this one particular line of questioning, and the silence is just deafening at this point. So hear me out. Let's play this one out. Boyajian star is an F-class main sequence star. So it's about halfway through a life with roughly half the span of our own star, right? So this means that the star is at about 2.5 billion years old. And it took life here on Earth a minimum of 3.7 billion years to go from primordial ooze to using radio waves. We probably actually had a little bit longer than that. Now, a statistical sample of one is not great. But using life on Earth as a model, it seems unlikely that life native to the Boyajian star system would have developed into a Kardashev 2-type civilization in 1.2 billion fewer years than it took us to get to basically like Kardashev 0.8. Following this line of thought, let's assume that any alien megastructure around Boyajian's star would have been built by aliens who traversed interstellar space in order to build it. Now, that in and of itself is not crazy. It's very likely that a civilization that could build a Dyson structure could also travel between the stars. Maybe not faster than light, but probably could be done with a generation starship or a sleeper ship or something like that. But here's the problem with that. So in 1.5 billion years, Boyajian's star is going to swell up and become a red giant. Its upper atmosphere will engulf any planets or structures currently in that habitable zone. And eventually its outer layers will expand away, maybe not quite as violently as a supernova, but I certainly would want a little more than a parasol protecting me if I were nearby. So when this violent process is over, a white dwarf star will remain, and it will have a habitable zone much closer in than the current habitable zone around the F-class star we see today. Now, at that point, the white dwarf stellar remnant would be perfect for a Dyson structure. Dwarf stars put out more than enough energy to sustain an advanced civilization. Dwarf stars can last for up to trillions of years compared to the paltry billions of main sequence stars. Importantly here, dwarf stars eventually die by quietly going dark without exploding in any way, shape, or form. Now, some dwarf stars can produce some very violent flares, and this is a developing area of study, but I would still rather engineer something to survive a super flare than any kind of stellar death. So these aliens we're imagining, who traversed interstellar space to set up a Dyson structure around Boyajian's star, not only chose a star that will render those structures uninhabitable within 2 billion years, but also remember they passed a perfectly good red dwarf, KIC 8462852b, the partner star, on their way down the gravity well. They could have spent less effort just getting to Boyajian star B. And anything that they built there would last orders of magnitude longer, trillions of years, instead of 1, maybe 1.5 billion, 2 at the absolute outside. Now, maybe Boyajian B is too close to the parent star for that star death in 2.5 billion years, right? No problem. Basically, 2/3 of the stars near our sun are red dwarfs, and the closest is over 4 light years away. Probably a safe distance. Probably there's a similar concentration around Boyajian's star. Okay, so maybe life really did evolve super fast on a habitable planet around Boyajian's star, and they got to Kardashev 2. Why then would they choose to build around Boyajian's star rather than KIC 8462852b, less than 1,000 astronomical units away? They wouldn't even need interstellar travel to see all of the time advantages of building a megastructure around a dwarf star compared to their parent star. I simply cannot see aliens building a megastructure in orbit of such terrible galactic real estate as Boyajian's star. It's one thing for us humans to build the California Memorial Stadium, but it's quite another for a highly developed race to basically build a planet around a star which is likely alien to them, which will last about 1% as long as it could have if they built it around a more suitable star, especially when such a star was right nearby. This is the kind of real estate blunder that would bankrupt Daddy's company. The moment KIC 8462852B was discovered, the brunt of our public SETI fixation on that star system should have refocused on it. Whatever's going on at the parent star is fascinating and important, but it's not aliens. And in recent years, the larger scientific community has pivoted to start considering alien life around red dwarf stars more seriously. And this is especially after the Kepler and TESS missions found scores of Earth-like planets orbiting these red dwarfs. In 2016, SETI, the organization, not the general effort, began surveying about 20,000 red dwarf stars using the Allen Telescope Array, the first study of its kind. They published their findings in 2018. I can only find the abstract, but if their results section were really that groundbreaking, I think we'd have all heard about it by now. Even if the survey failed to detect alien technosignatures, that's not the main point. The main point is to look for them, and I say this is an excellent move in the right direction. I think, since you asked my opinion, right? I think red dwarfs are prime candidates for finding civilizations more advanced than ours, not just because they're prime real estate, but because some of them have just been around for so long, because they're these incredibly stable, long-lasting stars. The 20,000 stars of this particular survey were taken from a catalog of 70,000, and it's estimated that something like 3/4 of all stars are red dwarfs. It feels like it's almost impossible to ignore them, really. And while we probably shouldn't be expecting aliens around Boyajian's star proper, I've said it before, and I stand by it. Whatever we do learn will be amazing, and it'll probably change how we think about things in one or two fundamental ways. I'm really looking forward to the results in the next couple of months as we begin the process of verifying the periodicity of these dips. I'm really looking forward to Professor Boyajian's interview with us here at Space Rants. And I also look forward to hearing from you. What do you think is the cause of these mysterious dimmings for Boyajian's star and other stars like it? What do you hope that we learn in the next couple of months and years as we continue to observe this star? What did I miss? Hit me up on the contact page of the Space Rants website, or find me on your social platform of choice. And that about wraps things up. Thank you so much for joining me. Please do follow this show wherever you get your podcasts and on social at Rants in Space. Depending on the platform, please make sure to like, share, comment, rate, subscribe, and or review. And if you can do so comfortably, it would be amazing if you would become a patron. Even now in the information age, nothing beats word of mouth. If you love the show, please tell all your friends. If you hated the show, just tell all your enemies. Our logo was designed by Kristen DeVico. Our theme music was composed by Jonathan Freund, and additional music from System Sounds. Links to all of these amazing artists are in the show notes. Please do go check them out. Make sure you're keeping socially distant. Wear a good mask or two. Sanitize your hands often. Don't touch your face. And I hope you're able to take some time for self-care. And if you get a chance, help someone today. I'll catch you on the flip side.